I want to talk to Tom from North Central Ohio today about the lack of availability of food for wildlife. Tom wrote me and said that in his decades of being a farmer, an agronomist, and in generally an observer of wildlife, he's seen many things, but nothing like what's going on this season. So we connected, and without any further ado, Tom, welcome, and why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, and then I'd love to hear what you're seeing.
Well, yes. My observations of nature and the way plants grow and the interactions of the various aspects of nature goes back to about 1969. And over the years, I've seen trends, I've seen cycles. I think about sine waves, there's ups and downs and ups and downs. And insect populations fluctuate somewhat along those lines. Seasonal temperature variations are somewhat along those lines. So when I see something changing, I generally don't get too upset about it, is what I'm trying to say.
You've got some perspective there, yeah.
Yeah, I do have perspective. However, I'm seeing some things that are beginning to alarm me, and it might be because they're part of a much bigger cycle, something that I haven't actually lived through before.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's the Milankovitch cycle of the orbit of the Earth, and what have you. And I mentioned a little bit of my background, but also during the course of my life, I had a daytime job. I'm retired now, in data processing, actually database analyst. And so I just thought I'd mention that so you got a little more of a feel for, my background.
So a bit, some quantitative experience there. And you're absolutely right. There are a number of cycles. We seem certainly to live in interesting times at the confluence of a number of cycles. What are you seeing?
Yes, I would say that at least on the surface, which means, from what I can tell, because I don't have a laboratory and I have limited time to do research, it certainly seems like there is a confluence of things happening. Now, one question I have is there anybody out there that really knows what's going on? I mean, you can read articles that say one thing, and a little bit later, there's another group of experts saying the opposite on not just one subject, mm-hmm. every subject, And I think for a lot of people, they just kind of have a my eyes glaze over response. Yeah. They just give up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would actually suggest that's intentional. They sort of just put out, the positive and the negative, and people are left to wonder which is true. And in the absence of any truth, they just sort of give up that search and go about their daily life. It's enough of a struggle just to make money and survive. So to actually sort through some of these issues when there's deliberate misinformation out there is challenging, if not downright impossible for some folks. So I think there's a strategy of tension at the knowledge level that's been enacted.
Oh, yeah.
And then the question becomes, well, beyond that, who within the establishment actually knows what's going on? And I think even I think your question is a poignant one. I'm not sure that anyone, even with access to the real data, has a perfect picture of what we're experiencing right now. There, as we said, there are so many cycles that are coming together and interacting in ways that we just can't predict. That it's sort of a only God knows at this point.
Amen, brother. Now, in regard to the focus of my previous message to you pertaining to what I'm seeing in the natural realm as opposed to, let's say, agriculture or politics, I have never seen such little food available for wildlife. And just take, for example, in my mind, I'm walking through my orchard. So in this corner, there's a pawpaw grove. which is not papaya. Here it's a Semina triloba, and it's the North American pawpaw. Now, they probably have the most amount of, well, the old-timers call it mast, M-A-S-T. It has to do with how many nuts and how many fruit are up in the trees for the hogs and wildlife. It's an old-fashioned term. But anyways, the fruit's probably only at 50%, and that is the best, or the species that is are bearing the most. From there, it goes downhill to various other species until you get to zero. I have complex hybrid chestnut trees, and they're bearing approximately 20% or less. I have butternut and Japanese walnut, and they're negligible. Most trees don't have any. Some trees have got three or four. And let's see, Quercus alba, which is the white oak, I have not seen a single acorn on them. There's a species of tree called the bur oak, which is part of the white oak group in the forests, except they have these giant acorns instead of the small white oak acorns. They're at zero. The list just goes on and on and on like that. Now, all of these various species, like I said, they go through phases. Sometimes the trees will get locked into a every other year of bearing scenario, but they're all off-cycle to each other. So white oaks might bear really good on year A and be off on year B, but the bur oaks will be just the opposite. I mean, God always provides his creatures with enough to eat as long as they're willing to go out and scratch in the dirt to get it. That's what my daddy always said. Now, there's impacts economically and agriculturally, and I'll tell you exactly what I expect. Deer, they're beautiful. I love deer, but they can destroy an orchard. Obviously, the males will rub their antlers just to mark scent to get the velvet off, but they'll eat the twigs, you know. They'll even eat the bark if they get hungry enough. So I expect to see a lot of deer damage this year. Also, the little field mice, voles and meadow mice and what have you, you know, in the wintertime, they get out and they forage under the snow. If they can't find the kind of food they want, they'll eat the roots. I'm serious. I mean, it doesn't look good. Now, if you use a lot of poisons, you know, like mouse bait, and you will allow hunters to try to eradicate the deer problem, I suppose all these things might have somewhat of an impact depending upon the size of your property and how many trees you have, you know, and how many hunters you're willing to have shooting at your house, which is not a pleasant thing. Oh, yeah, my apple trees, they're probably at 40%. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Well,
yeah, I'm kind of in a permaculture. I don't adhere to any particular agricultural philosophy, but I do believe in trying to make things as permanent as possible so you don't have to keep tilling the soil and disrupting the eco-environment and all that. And organic, I don't spray. Like I said, if you have enough diversity as these various species of trees and shrubs and what have you go through their natural cycles, there's always been more than enough for me and my family and the wild animals. I don't mind sharing at all.
Right. But is that, and so are you saying that's a little bit different this year, that you're having more pest pressure? Because certainly we've seen, you know, camels invading cities, and then there were kangaroos in Australia that during the drought, as you're saying, there's just less food available to wildlife. And so they have been invading cities and farms looking for food. Are you seeing much of that?
I have not seen it yet, but I expect to see it very shortly. Mm-hmm. It's in the
immediate future, throughout the summer, most animals, they don't, because the trees aren't bearing their fruits and nuts and what have you, they're eating various other food sources. Now, it's about time for frost now, and that'll kill all the herbaceous plants, grasses and the sedges, and the animals expect, they're counting on all this wild food out here, and it's not going to be there, and it's going to go downhill from there. And if there's one thing I can't, that's break my heart, is to see a starving, sick animal. It's a pitiful thing. And so I would expect even commercial agricultural orchardists and what have you to feel extreme pressure. And even when you put out mouse bait and you've got hunters on your land, there's going to be a lot of people complaining, and there's going to be economic loss. I mean, you can't be out there 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And you wake up one morning and you go out and you find about 20 or 30 trees have been destroyed. Makes you mad.
Yeah.
And that's just from one night.
And have you been seeing behavioral changes? You know, there have definitely been interruptions into the migratory patterns, and we've explored some of those. But what are you seeing as someone that's been watching your whole life in your neck of the woods? What's your sense?
Well, I have noticed a lot of changes, and I don't know if I should just try to focus on this particular season's behavioral patterns,
mm-hmm,
that have changed, or I could talk about behavioral, you know, changes going back a long ways. I'll give you a few long-term things that may not necessarily be related to the grand solar minimum, but all these things are coming into a confluence that I don't like, and I think it could be they could exacerbate the situation of food security. You'll see what I mean. Have you heard of a type of poison that's used in agriculture called neonicotinoids?
Oh, sure. Definitely lots of talk around the neonics and the honeybees. Yeah, definitely.
I've kept honeybees for decades, and it got to the point where I could not keep them populated. Mm. I had to give it up. And it just, that really broke my heart. I mean, oh, I used to just love to watch my bees, you know, and what have you. The songbird population is way down. And the ones that have been here this season, take, for instance, the little wrens, I believe they're called Carolina wrens. But normally they'll raise 2 broods a year here in this section of Ohio. Occasionally 3. This year they only raised 1 brood. And I really do think it was because of all the rainy, wet weather. It kept their food supply down.
Mm-hmm.
There's been years when we had so many mosquitoes here that after the sun would go down and the mosquitoes would start coming out of the deep, dark woods to the west of us, you could actually hear them coming in mass, that high-pitched sound that you get when a little mosquito's close to your ear, multiplied until you could hear them 100 yards away. Nothing like that. And the neonics are systemic, whereas the old-fashioned pesticides were topical. And you'd have to put it into an oil or a clay to make it stick around longer on the outside to prevent it from getting blown off or ringed off. The neonics really get absorbed into the plant tissue, every part of the plant tissue. And somebody said that they're persistent. Somebody said that, I forget where I read it at, but this will blow your mind. They only become neutralized after 200 days of sunshine shining on them.
Wow.
Yes. Now, I don't know exactly where you live, but in Ohio, we don't get 200 days of sunshine a year. I mean, if the neonics are on the surface of the ground, we've got 3 or 4 months of snow cover, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It takes forever for that stuff to get out of the system. It's ridiculous. And so that's something I'm watching, that when it coincides with extreme low temperatures, we've got our GDDs are way down and being wet. And I'm also concerned about the UV index.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't notice it. I don't need a scientific instrument. I can more or less unscientifically tell when the UV index is up, and it's up.
You can feel it, yeah.
Oh, sometimes if I walk out, it feels like it's burning my skin, and my eyes can see it. So I don't know if that's necessarily the sun or the atmosphere changing or a confluence of both.
Right. But either way, the effects that it's having are there.
Definitely. I used to do a lot of things scientifically, although, like I said, I'm not a scientist. For instance, you make a square out of wood lath or yardsticks that are 1 yard square,
mm-hmm.
and you hold it up into the tree, and you count how many fruits or nuts are up there, and you... I still keep a logbook. I keep records, but not like I used to. I used to try to quantify and qualify everything, and of course, you know, that's great. Gives me a little bit more of a background than the average person, perhaps, in making the assertions that I do.
And so that's a way to quantify the yield off those fruit trees, how densely they're producing?
Exactly. That's it, exactly. But you get to the point of where... being precise is not nearly as important. I'm not going to be submitting a scientific report.
Mm-hmm.
I just eyeball it. Write it down in my journal.
Yeah, and certainly we're getting a sense directionally of where we're going right now.
Yeah. So, Chris, where you are, if you've noticed any increase or decrease in any populations?
Definitely the insect population seems to be reducing, and that, you know, those are my own observations that seem to jive with the publications we've seen about massive 75% die-off of insect biomass over the last few years here. And so I would say it's not that they're completely gone, but there are fewer and different species than folks are used to around here.
There you go. Now, I can't help thinking about pestilence. What do they call it when the insects swarm and eat up fields?
The plague of locusts.
Yeah, things like that. Of course, there can be natural triggers of reproduction that makes a species, not necessarily just locusts, but other species, to trigger a population explosion.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed this spring, I mean, actually, it was late winter, the deer here are basically nocturnal, so you only see like their hoof prints and what they've been eating and where they've been going to the bathroom and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never seen so many at that time yearling deer tracks. They're like half-sized deer.
Mm-hmm.
They go through the winter and they do the remainder of their growth in their second season. I've never seen so many yearling deer tracks as I did late winter through early spring. And I have not seen a lot of mortality as far as coming across carcasses or anything. But, like I said before, my assertion is they're normally, they'll go up there and they'll start eating the acorns and the chestnuts, the apples that are on the ground. They want to get, you know, fat and sassy to head into the horrible cold of winter with a chance.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to have that. They're going to be stripping everything. Maybe not on the scale of a biblical plague, but I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people saying, what the heck happened to my apple tree, or something like that.
And so you're saying, I'm trying to understand, was it an explosion in the deer population that just means there's more of them to feed, or that they aren't growing because of a lack of availability of their food?
It's just that there will be much more of them to feed. Every parcel has a carrying capacity, and of course that's that means, of course, I know, you know, but how many of any given species a parcel of ground can carry. And obviously a desert can't carry a lot of, let's say, foragers like deer. But they can probably carry more desert tortoises than Ohio can, you know. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. And there's a lot of toxic plants, a lot of plants which they normally don't touch. We would call it a famine food. It either doesn't taste good or it has noxious chemicals in it that can even make them sick. Or maybe there's a, believe it or not, there's different types of roughage in, as far as digestibility goes. And that can have an impact on whether or not they stay healthy or get sick. So, yeah, they might switch over to a famine food, and then you'll see all these starving, sick animals around, and that's just not good.
And are you seeing that this year?
No, not yet. But once again, basically, we'll start seeing the change more after September. Mm-hmm. The animals begin harvesting the fall nuts and fruits and what have you in the months that end in R, September, October, November, December. And once January hits, they usually have it cleaned up pretty good. And since, you know, all food has its season as far as harvestability, once that block of food is gone, if they're not healthy and you know, it's just a metaphor. I call it fat and sassy, ready to go ahead. Winter's bleak. It's the dying time. Anything that's sick or whatever, it's not going to make it.
Yeah, winter is coming. And, you know, we focused so much on the effects on, well, particularly on corn of the flooding across the Midwest. But but now, yeah, now we're really going to see things, other things come home to roost, many of which we just couldn't have even imagined. And so it sounds like much like the losses to our food system are going to be more pronounced, and we'll see those food prices start to rise as it percolates through the food system. Just the same now with the animals, they're sort of cleaning their plate from what is available now, but it's during the winter that this really comes home and hits home.
Definitely. And if you're interested, as the season progresses, I'll periodically give you some updates, you know, because, of course, I have, I hate to use the word expectations, I do have my expectations as to, you know, what's going to come about. It's a question of degree and the ramifications. When the animals start changing their eating habits and foraging habits, it changes, this is long term, it changes the species in the forests. Whereas you might have predominantly in one area, let's say cherry, and the animals are forced to start eating them and eating them down, well, possibly the next species to move in would be your less desirable species. I mean, I'm not a plant snob, but a lot of farmers would call it junk species, you know, mm-hmm. shrubs and junk like that, you know. But, yeah, let me tell you, this spring, the farmers, okay, let me just take a breath and take a step back. All farmers expect a certain amount of growing season. And let's just say in a given area, they buy the longest season corn seed that they can grow, because it maximizes your profits. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to belittle profits. If you don't make a profit, you go bankrupt, and then everything's over. Yep. But basically, let's say, I'm trying to remember now, you go with 130-day to maturity corn. That's mm-hmm. As long as your growing season will be. Well, that'll produce a plant on average six feet high with two medium-sized ears. Okay, this spring comes along. It's so cold and wet. The vast bottomland farms were flooded out, period. Plus, modern agricultural equipment cannot drag their huge tractors and what have you, you know, their equipment, out into these muddy fields. They have to wait. All of a sudden, after so many days, if they have already bought their 130-day seed corn, they are desperate to trade it in to DeKalb or Arthur Daniels Midland or Monsanto or one of the other seed companies. And the seed companies realize that the weather is a dynamic thing, and they always have reserves of shorter season to maturity corn or wheat or what have you. Mm-hmm. But they, in my opinion, there's no way they could have been prepared for the enormous demand for the switchover this spring.
Yep.
Now, I haven't seen any sales figures or anything like that, but I know that a lot of these farmers had to use what they had originally purchased, and their corn is not going to mature properly, mm-hmm. and they're going to be severely penalized for it. When they bring in and try to sell their crops, their corn or whatever, they analyze what they're bringing in. They analyze it for weed seeds, for density, for starch, moisture, dust, everything. And then they quote them a price. And it's not going to be pretty in that respect, especially for the poor farmers who couldn't switch over to, let's say, 110-day corn.
Yeah, and certainly we've seen tales of farmers who were actively trying to make that switch out to faster maturing earlier varieties. And while the seed companies don't make public statements about how their internal inventories, you know, they don't want to release that kind of data about how stressed they are.
Exactly.
But when we talk about the systemic stresses on modern agriculture, I can confirm that I've heard from folks inside those companies that, you know, there are fire drills going on right now. Levels are lower than they should be, and they're not, you know, things are not well. And so I think your suspicion is well-founded there.
I have not seen any figures. Like you said, they don't want to publish and have their competitors get a leg up on their plans.
Exactly.
So it's business. They hold their cards close to their chest, so to speak. In my view, the seed companies do not react quickly to a situation. They try to. They know that nature's cyclical, but within a certain
some threshold.
Level.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, and there, if something happens that pushes things beyond that threshold, they don't have the inventory. They don't have the supply. They didn't prepare for it, you know? And so if the grand solar minimum and some of these other things that are coming together at this point in time, mm-hmm. push them beyond that threshold, it's going to stress the agriculture even further. And sometimes I wonder, you know, I'm like Will Rogers, the great American humorist. I only know what I read in the papers, you know. I only know what I read on the internet. How much of this is propaganda? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a worldwide push, like Agenda 2030, try to make everyone eat, you know, become vegetarians, you know? And there was I'll not say the name, a famous modern American politician that said, never let any crisis go unexploited.
Yep, good old Ron, yep.
To push their agenda. Don't get me wrong, there's been several times in my life I've tried to go vegetarian, and I think it's admirable if you can do it for whatever reason. I don't judge anybody, you know? But, and I know the argument that for every pound of beef, it takes 10 pounds of grain, and that 10 pound of grain, each pound takes 10 pounds of water or 10 gallons of water, you know? So, yeah, I understand all that. But, well, what we used to consider the good old days from here to 2030, I think, are going to be under pressure. One of these days, we're going to wake up and the good old days will be gone.
I think we're there now, Tom. And let me ask you, so you offered to come back and share some observations as we get towards winter and we start to see, you know, those animals running out of their foods. And so, first of all, thank you for that offer. And I'd love to take you up on that. I think that is the kind of data that we need to be recording and sharing and helping people understand what's going on. And it's also the kind of data that can get other folks to open their eyes. You know, if they different people are triggered by different things, and so that's, we just have to stay on top of those things. So thank you for offering that. And then I'm curious, when you say you know, there are thresholds that everything operates in, from the plants themselves to the seed companies, but we're testing those thresholds, and in some cases, you know, breaking things, right? When there are canned food shortages across Kroger and Walmart, I think we're seeing the cracks in the edifice here. What do you see happening as we exceed those thresholds and really hit a breaking point? How do you see that playing out?
I don't know how deep you'd like to get into this, but I do have some ideas and feelings about this that I don't think a lot of people would be comfortable with, because it's not good news. Mm-hmm. Take, for example, the situation in Mexico. Now, granted, southern Mexico currently has got a lot of jungle and forest and what have you. And of course, they get the hurricanes blowing in a lot of times, so they get a lot of moisture. But the vast majority of Mexico is marginal land, okay? Mm-hmm. And they're very dependent upon inputs. The only way, there's an agricultural phrase that says the only way to have big outputs is to have big inputs, water and fertilizer. As and they're facing the same type of threats, if you will, that Americans are, United States citizens are. It's going to hit them harder. Now think about it. If they start losing their jobs and their food prices go up, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to try to find some place that they can live. So that has dire consequences for everyone, mm-hmm. for multiple countries. That's, you know, I hesitate to even mention it. People, they hear bad news and they put up a wall and their eyes glaze over. Mm-hmm. That's just one thing. Sociologically, in the United States, we're going to see not less and less control. We're going to see more and more control.
Absolutely.
We're going to see it generally in the forms of corporations gaining more and more power over our lives. And, of course, government is always the handmaiden in this particular political economic setup. Government is always the handmaiden of the corporations. They'll be there to help things along, of course. We're going to see more bankruptcies. We're going to see more collectivizations of farms. It's funny. In the Soviet Union, they had their five-year plans for economic growth, agricultural growth, and economic output. Mm-hmm. And especially in the beginning, it was very brutal with the Ukraine, the starvation in the Ukraine. And people wonder, how could that happen? What was it, 3-point-something million people starved to death in the nation of Ukraine? It's
horrific.
Easy.
Yeah.
The government said, we own your food. And they would just send a commissar, a political commissar, and a soldier with a rifle. And they knock on your door, and they go through everything. They make sure you're not hoarding food under the floorboards of your barn. And if you did, they'd shoot you. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that it's going to get that bad here, but I'm just showing you and everyone the level of control that can be exerted and has been exerted in the past. Look at the Irish potato famine. People say, how could that have happened? I'll tell you how. England said, we own your wheat. We own your barley. You're not allowed to eat any of it or keep any of it. The only thing that people could eat is what they grew in their, well, we'd call them gardens, you know, little quarter acre to 1 acre fields of potatoes and what have you, you know. Mm-hmm. And when the potato blight came, all their wheat was exported to England. Mm-hmm. That's how it happens. So somewhere between where we're at now and the two extremes I just shared with you is the path we're going down, a greater level of control. And So it's not a pretty picture. I don't mean to be doom and gloom. I'll tell you one positive thing. The people that will get through it are the people that band together in community. I don't care if you're in a city, in a suburb, in the country. We today were isolates. Oh, a lot of people, they are sociable. They have their circle of friends. But they're like party friends. You know, how serious of a friendship do they have?
Mm-hmm.
But if people start working together in community for their, let's say, their own security against violence, their own food security,
mm-hmm.
they start studying and sharing information on how to find cheaper food or food that is on sale or food that they can grow in a shorter growing season. You can buy 80-day corn. But you have to probably order it, you know, make an effort to order it out of a seed catalog or off the internet. And I 1 year grew a variety of corn called Painted Mountain Corn. And it was a real short season corn, less than 100 days. Most beautiful corn I've ever seen in my life. Here I go, talking like a farmer. Most beautiful little corn ears you ever saw. Each corn kernel looked like a gem. And so it can be a pleasurable thing to explore. It mm-hmm. doesn't have to be all work and no play.
I just want to point out these extreme situations you were pointing out, both the, you know, the control by central governments, but also the mass migrations. This isn't just wild speculation of some guy imagining. This is what has happened time and time again in the previous cycles, the previous grand solar minimum. We always see mass migration of people because there's not enough food available. That's what people do when there's not food. They move to look for food. So it is absolutely in the cards. It's not a wild speculation. Maybe this could happen. It's, you know, it's beginning. And in fact, we've seen some of the Vietnamese farmers who have been growing for generations, but finding that they weren't able to produce crops, and there millions of them are just moving, so many of them into the cities, you know, more people herded into the smart cities being dependent on modern agriculture. But you're absolutely right. And I think you're right. Let's now, what are some of those beautiful solutions, and how do people deal with this? How do you move forward?
Well, again, like I said, it doesn't matter where you live. Even, let's say, in the inner city, there are vacant lots. There are community gardens. That's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
At least, you know, it's a place to start. The best thing to do is to try to find people of like mind who are concerned. And, you know, we as human beings, we can kind of detect after a little bit of time if the person is fairly serious, you know, to commit to a plan of action,
mm-hmm.
a plan of cooperation. And I don't think it would take too long at all to develop a group, a kernel of people working towards a goal. And what would be really neat is if this people could also have an outreach ministry, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
to help educate other people, to put the word out, you know, to be kind of like food activists, and to just try and help as many people as you can. Now, there's levels of collapse. Nobody knows how bad it's going to get, but you certainly can pick up bits and pieces as to, like, Agenda 2030 and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
There's levels of collapse, and so what is appropriate in one time frame, which may cover 1 to 5 years, may not be appropriate for another time frame. There's no one answer fits all, you know?
Yeah.
And, of course, it's a human attribute to always to be able to think on your feet and to react appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it's how we treat each other that matters.
Mm-hmm. And so what steps are you taking to prepare?
I'm talking to you. And I've tried to diversify my tree crops. And in spite of that, they're still having a hard time. So that was like plan A. And to be honest, I never thought I would need a plan B. But believe you me, I'm now thinking, you know, about a plan B. Right now, my health isn't the best, so I can't do a lot of physical labor in a garden or a big garden or what have you. Mm-hmm. But I can do some things, and I do keep myself active and exercise. And I like to reach out to people. Like, I've got an Amish neighbor. He lives right across the road. Of course, you know what Amish are, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to explain. Okay. He built his house in late spring. This was like a couple of years ago before we had this cold, wet spring and summer. Mm-hmm. Anyways, and so he got a late start. And his garden didn't go in until about June or so. And an Amish garden is about an acre, you know. It's not a little garden. And he was complaining that, you know, he had wanted to get sweet corn in, but it was too late. I said, go to this seed catalog, you know, and look up their shortest season. You'll get something. Mm-hmm. May not have 2 ears per stalk, you know, and it the cobs might be 3/4 or half the size, but by gosh, you'll get something. He thanked me later on. Mm-hmm. Because that's exactly what he did, and he was able to get his sweet corn out of his garden.
Outstanding.
But what happens if we have a year without a summer?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay, we just ramped it up. We went into high gear. What if this solar minimum is due to galactic forces as well as internal forces within the sun, and that they kind of, one affects the other, and let's say all these cosmic rays affect the geology of the Earth, like volcanism.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say a Krakatoa goes off, a Cumbre Vieja, you know, or one of these other super volcanoes, and you have a year without a summer. Well, let me tell you, I don't even like to think about that.
Yep, it's a game changer. Game changer.
Yeah, it wouldn't be pretty. I have studied the handwritten journals of pioneers that lived through that whole time,
mm-hmm.
It was not pretty at all. First of all, they came out here to the Northwest, what they called the Northwest Territory, which was basically Ohio and the surrounding states, and it was a frontier,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them had started their operations before the year without a summer. I mean, they had to cut down the giant trees and try to get plants growing. Of course, they would have a few hogs and a cow and what have you, and they'd write, you know, for the first 2 or 3 or 4 years, they ate some form of corn for morning, noon, and night. Corn mush, corn pone, corn cakes, corn this, corn that. One of their children wrote 40 years later, Daddy never could stand to eat corn. And one day she asked him why, and he told her, you know, I ate it until I couldn't stand it. And another handwritten story, there was a population explosion of squirrels. And one year, all the mast failed. And the farmers reported they would hear something moving through the big woods. And they got louder and louder. Sounded like a bunch of animals. And what it was the squirrels were migrating in mass, in a big wave. They were running through the trees, they were all heading in the same direction, starving to death.
Yeah.
And they said the worst thing was they were also running along the ground, eating everything in their path. Now, you know, you go to the park, you might see one squirrel, who knows, depending on where you're at, you might see 10 squirrels. What if they started in, let's say, central Pennsylvania, heading west towards the Mississippi. And as they go, every other squirrel joins them. By the time they get out to the Mississippi, you'll have a mountain of squirrels like a plague of locusts, you know?
Wow.
I mean, when you look at these aberrations of nature and you think it's happened in the past, what triggered it, you know? Study it, try to figure out what's going on, and could it happen again? People don't like to think about that.
I had never heard of that. That's amazing. I do see many instances in the 19th century and even one back in the 1749 in Pennsylvania. Hundreds of thousands of squirrels. Here's a million that were turned in at a cost of 3 cents each to the state. So they were trying to kill off exactly, it was a pest, a pack of squirrels devouring everything there. I have never heard of that. That's fascinating.
Yep. So, Chris, you know, I try to put some positive spins on things, and every human generation has faced challenges, great and small. And in my mind, you know, it's how we treat each other and trying to do good that really counts. And I think we'll have plenty of opportunity to try to help other people in the upcoming years.
Yeah, and that's well done. That's a good way to frame it, because it's easy to get caught up looking at the big picture and say, good Lord, we need really big solutions here, when in fact, as individuals, it is only within our sphere, you know, our circle of influence that we can act. And what that means is exactly as you say, just be good to each other. Do things that benefit us all. And, you know, with a picture for these larger problems that we're facing and what solutions would look like, but just acting, you know, strongly within that sphere of influence and trying to spread the word. I think you nailed it.
Exactly. Without human love and kindness and support, what's the use?
Exactly. Well said. Well, Tom, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today, and I definitely want to follow up as the winter gets underway here and keep an eye on sort of the trends you're seeing and what's going on there.
I will, and thank you so much. It's good to talk to a kindred soul, and I certainly do enjoy and support your efforts with Ice Age Farmer. You certainly do a lot of research, it's obvious, and the information you're sharing is garnering a lot of attention. I think it's a true voice, you know, amongst the din and chaos of let's just call it fake news for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that, Tom, and awesome. We'll connect again in the future, and thanks so much.